We will attempt at least to call the meeting of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force to order. The subject of today's hearing is the Minnesota Energy Emergency Plan. It is a comprehensive plan in terms of various forms of energy. Sort of goes beyond the scope of electric energy generation, but as I'm sure most of you are aware, the Electric Energy Task Force will be sort of transformed into the Legislative Energy Commission on January 1st, and I think it's appropriate that we begin considering some of these things from that broader perspective. So we have asked Deputy Commissioner Garvey from the Office of Energy Security to review the plan. We also have Commissioner Campion from the Department of Public Safety and Chris Ide from Homeland Security present to answer questions that might arise within their scope of interest. So, Commissioner Garvey, if you want to proceed with the presentation, members, you do have a copy in front of you of the emergency plan, as well as a copy of the presentation we're about to have from Commissioner Garvey.
I got it right here.
Commissioner, I think what we will do, given the nature of this material, is invite members to interrupt with questions as we go along rather than wait until the end. So, members, please feel free to raise questions as they occur to you in the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Edward Garvey. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce and the Director of the Office of Energy Security. Joining me is Jeff Haas, who is the lead within the department on the emergency energy plan that we will go through with you. Before you, you have a copy of the plan itself. You have a set of a copy of an overhead presentation that we will give you. So first, I will cover the first several slides, which is an overview of energy emergency issues and how we perceive it from a macro look. And then Mr. Haas will walk you through the details of the plan itself. In addition, before you, you have the sort of the applicable statute that the plan is drafted based upon, as well as a report that we do each week on fuel. So in the sense that we do keep track fuels and in the context of an energy emergency, to some extent we can sort of see some of the trends both on a price and a supply basis. So with that, Mr. Chairman, let me just sort of start with the presentation. When we think about energy, we think and need to make sure we are thinking about it in the context of the three types of energy systems. There's the electrical system, generation, transmission, and distribution. There's the natural gas. There's the interstate pipelines, the connections with the local distribution companies. And then, of course, there's petroleum and transportation fuels. Each of these have a different set of business models, a different set of players, a different set of regulatory regimes that are applicable to them. And they create different types of emergencies because we use them differently. The other thing to bear in mind is it does sort of get complicated because as we start moving up, there are more moving pieces when you start thinking about emergencies. There are different types of emergencies. There's emergencies based upon supply or supply shortages. There are emergencies based upon reliability or the lack of a supply of energy. You have economic emergencies, i.e. the price of a product. or a type of energy fuel moves beyond a reasonable or outside of a reasonable range. And then you have, of course, health and environment emergencies that are related to an energy supply failure or an energy emergency. So not only do you have the three types of energies and the four different types of emergencies that could occur, they have different types of scale, scope, and severity and duration. So you have different types. I mean, in terms of the scope, how many people are affected? You can have an emergency that it just affects a very few sets of people, or you can have a very wide, multi-state type of an emergency. How many energy systems, the scope, the interconnection of our energy systems is something that adds to the complexity. You have an electrical supply problem that causes a problem with fuels, et cetera, et cetera. You need to understand the interconnectivity of those. And then there's the severity and the duration of those kinds of problems. So as we think about emergencies and preparing to address those emergencies, we have to think about all these moving pieces more or less simultaneously, but also in a very fluid, both reactive and proactive way, Mr. Chairman and members of the task force. Let me just sort of walk through several examples, again at a high level, to show the examples of an interconnectedness of the energy system. The supplies of one system affect the supplies of another. Electricity is needed to pump natural gas down the pipelines or down the oil pipelines. If there's an outage on any of those systems that last along, the pipelines may have a problem. Then you have to start having fuel issues. Similarly, you frequently have for electrical generation, you're relying on some kinds of petroleum-based fuels. If you can't get them, so the interconnection of those kinds of examples come into play. Natural gas is used for electrical generation, et cetera, et cetera. You start seeing these interconnectivity kinds of things. The causes of emergencies are as diverse as the emergencies themselves and the issues that we're facing. But just to give you sort of a couple of examples, there's sort of the flooding / natural disaster kind of examples. We've seen floods in this state, but we've also seen tornadoes and other kinds of natural disasters having an effect on the energy supply and creating emergencies for the people of Minnesota. We've had infrastructure failures. Those can create emergencies of various natures themselves. Public health kinds of emergencies. It is something that we pay attention to in the context of the post-9/11 world is that we do want to pay attention to sabotage and terrorism and those kinds of threats. And then, of course, there's this, you know, there's potential civil disobedience, civil disturbance, where you see people, you know, from as random as someone taking pot shots at transformers on power lines to something more severe. And each of these things need to be thought about when you start thinking about an emergency energy plan. It's also important from our perspective to understand that there are many players and participants and actors in addressing the emergencies and the energy emergencies themselves. The utilities, natural gas and electricity, of course, the primary manager, protector, planner, entity to address an emergency on their system are those utilities. Similarly, in a petroleum-based setting and for pipelines and for refining, those entities are the primary initial responders to any kind of action on their systems. Beyond that, then you have the first responders from the local municipalities, cities, counties, etc. Those are the folks that rush, as we all know. They have their duties and responsibilities to respond to any kind of any kind of emergency, but also the energy emergency. And they have developed very close working relationships with the utilities, because we all know we have been paying attention to and working out with scenarios where these kinds of facilities are. From the state perspective, as Chairman Hilty Authority indicated, there is a Department of Public Safety and the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Office who has a state participatory role at this level, too. And as Mr. Chairman already indicated, Commissioner Campion and Director Ide is here to be able to answer some of the specific kinds of questions that you may have on their very important role at this level. Beyond that, once you've identified and moved beyond those kinds of first responders at the utility level, at the actual facility level, and then the first responder and public safety level, you do have other entities at the governmental and regional level that come into play. And this is where, candidly, the Department of Commerce comes into play, and this is where this emergency plan that we're going to walk you through in a couple minutes will start describing some of those in detail. There's also regional entities, when you start thinking about it, as in the electricity and the natural gas field that come into play. I'm now trying to get to the next slide, Mr. Chairman. We seem to have a minor emergency.
Send to the first responders.
Yeah.
Send them the first responders.
Okay. This was working so well, sir.
It's a cyber emergency. There we go.
Did I? All right.
Nope. Just.
Did it go one slide?
Nope. It's right on.
All right. I'm now going to walk through some of the vulnerabilities that we've identified on the energy infrastructure systems that we've sort of talked about. Two that we've identified most particularly on the electrical system has been the transmission line vulnerability. It is one of the, we have a large number of many miles of transmission in the state and in the region. They're significant because they carry large amounts of power. They're connected. Now, we have double circuiting. We have some built-in redundancies, and the utilities work very hard, but we need to pay attention that those are some of the more vulnerable parts of a electrical grid system. They can be taken out by an ice storm, a tornado, or those kind of things. And we pay attention to those. And the plan that we're going to walk you through describes some of those. On a longer-term basis, this is something that this task force and you as individual legislators have been paying a lot of attention to, has been grid congestion itself. We do sort of basically view the grid congestion and the inability to basically move power as a potential emergency, because it does create the potential for economic problems, it has a potential for supply problems, etc. So it is one of those kind of things that we do pay attention to. Natural gas, the identified possible emergency causes are extended periods of extreme cold, where we basically use up the supply that we've sort of planned for, and you have to go beyond the normal contingencies. The utilities themselves, working with my department and the Public Utilities Commission, works very hard to avoid these kind of things. They have sets of mechanisms and fail-safes, but it is one of the ones you start thinking through. Loss of a pipeline or a pumping station and those kind of things and other key components to a pipeline system and our vulnerabilities that we need to be paying attention to when you start identifying and planning scenarios for emergency counter approaches. Then again, having a long-term risk associated with a sufficient line capacity, making sure that our infrastructure is capable of meeting our growing needs so you don't have the lines and the shortages is one of those ones that we do pay attention to. You don't really think about that in the context of emergency planning, but you do think about that as, when you think about it as a larger macro policy approach. Petroleum emergencies, the ones that we've sort of highlighted here, are supply emergencies generally at a refinery level or in a pipeline level. With all of these energy infrastructures, I think it's important to know that they are networked, and therefore they have, as a network, have built-in redundancies and capabilities. So when you have a refinery that is down or a power plant that is down, you have built-in redundancies, and as a rule, the marketplace doesn't see it. The supplies aren't interrupted at all. Having said that, you do want to make sure you start understanding when you start seeing multiple kinds of facility impacts and appreciating their potential impacts on the system. And those certainly petroleum or transportation fuel have a tendency of showing up most specifically in economic emergencies when we start sort of seeing high costs of gasoline and high costs of diesel and those kinds of things. You start sort of seeing those kinds of emergencies. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to now sort of, this goes into sort of the heart of the plan itself. I think it'd be most beneficial to the task force if Mr. Haas continues the presentation and walking you through the statutes and the plan and the document data itself. So with that, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Haas.
Well, certainly, Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you. And good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the task force. Before I get right into the plan itself, I just want to discuss a couple of the legal authorities that we have for developing and maintaining the plan. The statutory authority is provided in Minnesota statutes.
Before you proceed, we do need you to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, yes, I apologize. My name is Jeff Hawes. I'm within the Office of Energy Security. I work on energy emergency planning activities as well as demand-side management activities, working with utilities on their conservation efforts per the new 1.5% requirements.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The enabling statute is Minnesota statute section 216C.15 does provide the commissioner of the Department of Commerce with the statutory authority to establish rules and procedures for handling energy emergency supplies, energy supply emergencies, and it does require that the commissioner maintain an energy emergency conservation and allocation plan, which I'll discuss in more detail a little later on, and it relates to the operational plan contained within the energy emergency plan itself. There are a series of rules surrounding energy supply emergencies. These are somewhat focused on petroleum emergencies, and there's a kind of a call-down list based on the severity of the energy emergency. One of the first things that our office could do is issue an energy supply alert, which would be based on a six-month forecast. Looking out 6 months, we foresee that there is a potential for an energy supply emergency to exist, which would basically put us on a higher alert and require that we monitor and keep ourselves apprised of the energy supply situation in a little more detail.
Mr. Haas, what would the criteria be for making that determination?
Well, the criteria would be based on the looking 6 months out. If we, for instance, saw that there was going to be a potential for a heating oil shortage or a disruption for petroleum supplies coming into the state, that wouldn't necessarily reduce our supplies beyond 25%, for instance, that we could then put ourselves in a situation where we monitor and start issuing some educational campaigns surrounding the appropriate use and conservation of those fuels. There isn't necessarily a hard definition that would come into play, but the commissioner himself has the ability to issue that energy supply alert based on some of the information that would be available to our office.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, we were looking very closely at that and thinking through those kinds of issues a couple of years ago after Hurricane Katrina and Rita and trying to monitor the process and trying to sort of figure that out. Unfortunately, we came to the conclusion that we didn't have to because the system seemed to have enough redundancy and strong enough to be able to manage itself out at the six-month mark.
Thank you. Senator Brettner Solo.
Is it Haas?
Yes.
H-A-S-S?
H-A-A-S-E.
Or Haase, as I call it.
Okay. Mr. Haas, is there a federal plan that we need to coordinate with, or can we operate our own plan independent of that?
There are federal plans, and we tend to coordinate more regionally with our regional state counterparts, and there's an effort currently underway between us, the state of Minnesota, and the FEMA Region 5 states to develop some more consistency between each of the state's individual energy plans, energy emergency plans. The plans themselves have been developed using the NASIO, National Association of State Energy Officials, Energy Emergency Assurance Guidelines, and those were developed in part with cooperation from the Office of Electricity Reliability or Electricity Delivery and Energy Reliability, which is an arm of the Department of Energy that is focused on response to energy supply emergencies. They're often some of the folks that are the boots on the ground in the event of a severe weather event. For instance, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005 saw a response from the Office of Energy Electricity Reliability, Electricity Delivery and Energy Reliability. Their name seems to change every 6 months, so I apologize for kind of messing that up. So there is that type of coordination that takes place. In addition, there's been a group of the Energy Emergency Assurance Coordinators that have they work to try to have monthly conference calls to discuss energy supply issues. And again, this has taken place more on a regional basis rather than a national basis, because we've found that when there are emergencies, they tend to affect us more regionally than they otherwise would be.
Mr. Haas, since there is a National Association of State Energy Officials in Minnesota, who would be our state energy official? I don't recall that title being bestowed on anyone. Would that be you,
Mr. Chairman? Our official member of NASIO is Janet Streff, one of the supervisors of our State Energy and Information Office.
Thank you.
Okay. kind of the second level, the energy supply alert kind of puts us into a more alerted state. And then from that, the second level would be an energy supply emergency, which is based on a shorter-term 3-month forecast that would require that both mandatory, voluntary and mandatory conservation measures may be enacted. The commissioner in this, in the event of an energy supply emergency, does not have the sole authority for declaring a supply emergency, but must request that an energy supply emergency be, or recommend that an energy supply emergency be declared to the Executive Council or the Minnesota Legislature. Again,
Mr. Austin,
yes.
With respect to the forecast, is that who's making that forecast? Is that information from the EIA, or where does that come from?
This would be information from both the EIA as well as from our office through our petroleum monitoring activities, which I believe everyone has a copy of. Those supply monitoring activities are related to the availability of wholesale fuels in our bulk terminals throughout the state. They're aggregated so as not to divulge any company-specific information, but they provide us an indication of where we are relative to both the 3-year average for those fuels, as well as a 4-day average or a 4-week average. Of those fuel supplies.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Garvey,
in the immediate aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, Mr. Haas and I were on daily conference calls that were being pulled together from across the nation where we are all pooling our information, because, you know, for petroleum, we don't produce the petroleum here in Minnesota. We're dependent upon, you know, petroleum that's produced sort of several states away, and we're sort of always in those kinds of. So as you see an emergency, there's a set of communication channels that are opened up between the states and folks at our level, but we get those kinds of information too. So you take our baseline information, or we're monitoring on a weekly basis and working with the refineries and the pipelines, and you augment that with the information on the ground that are coming back through the other channels.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator Mattson.
I'm not familiar with this term, emergency supply. Emergency is given to the Executive Council of the Legislature. What's that? Who is that? Am I one of them? I'm not. I guess maybe I'm the only one in the room that's not understanding who the Executive Council, who you report to on this shortage or on the recommendations or the supply.
Senator, I think it's the the Executive Council or the legislature.
Oh, I was adding an F in there, huh?
Yeah. Well, so I think
okay,
it's just the
Executive Council. Okay, I guess I don't report this group. Sorry. That was a very good question, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Maybe we need.
I guess it's one or the other. Okay.
Maybe we need one of those.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm quite sure in the crisis that Senator Mattson is at least a member of one of them.
Absolutely.
Not both. We should work on that.
He could be the member of the executive.
Mr. Haas, go ahead.
Could happen.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I will point out that the entire text of Minnesota Rule 7620 is included in the Energy Emergency Plan on page 93. as far as the Energy Emergency Plan is concerned, this was developed in 2006, between 2006 and 2007, with a grant from Homeland Security and Emergency Management that was secured by our office. It was prepared by the National Association of State Energy Officials and is based on their State Energy Assurance Guidelines. And Deputy Commissioner Garvey mentioned that it does cover electricity, natural gas, and petroleum supply emergencies. The plan itself is organized into five sections: the legal authority, who the key Minnesota stakeholders are, there's a challenges or vulnerability assessment, and then the operational plan, along with some appendices related to basic information about the energy supply infrastructure in Minnesota, and as well as maps of electric utility service territories and other utility maps to supply some basic information. In the event that an energy emergency an energy supply emergency was declared, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, under the rules that are in place, would activate the State Emergency Operations Center. The Department of Commerce, through the Office of Energy Security, would analyze the situation and recommend the least restrictive measures contained within Rule 7620 to eliminate the shortage.
Mr. Haas, we have a question from Representative Horton.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It had to do with the previous slide. I'm sorry I wasn't very quick on the take here. But this has to do with the key Minnesota stakeholders. And I perused the plan very quickly, and I didn't see the Met Council there. And the reason I ask, and I may have just overlooked that, the reason I ask is I think that, given a petroleum type of emergency, issues like telecommuting, increased transit, carpooling, things of that nature, You know, I think they have some particular expertise in it. I saw that you have MnDOT coordinating all of that, but I'm wondering if any thought was given to involving the Met Council, particularly because of the transit, telecommuting, carpooling expertise they have. Are they involved and engaged in any of these conversations?
Mr. Ross.
They, Met Council is not specifically engaged in the discussions. However, the where we hope to assist the public in helping to deal with an energy emergency is through the release of public information campaigns. And that is an area that we would certainly work with the Met Council on to develop the appropriate public information for telecommuting and other response measures that could be enacted in the event of an emergency.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Horns.
It's something I guess I would just encourage because
sure.
This is a huge part of, I think, at least, again, an oil-based type of emergency. I think they have some options that, okay. that could be
Mr.
useful.
Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the statute that you handed out of Subdivision 3, it says the Executive Council or the Legislature may declare an emergency energy supply emergency. If the legislature is in session, I can understand how we would do it. If we're not in session, is there an abbreviated way for the legislature to declare this? Does the governor have to call us back into session to do it, or is it at that point the executive council that has to do it? Is there a process for this?
Commissioner Gowrie?
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Tomasoni. It is my recollection, because we were exploring this during the Katrina and Rita situation, which occurred in a September timetable, August-September timetable, when, of course, the legislature was not in session, was that the reason the statute is drafted the way it is, the Executive Council or the legislature, was that the Executive Council could be convened to declare a energy emergency when, for purposes of when the legislature was not in session, and that the only way the legislature could be convened is if the governor called a special session. And so the way we understand the statute was drafted so that the governor didn't have to call a special session to deal with this, that the executive council would be able to trigger that. That's the way I recall the analysis back after the Katrina and Rita timeline.
Mr. Hans.
And I will just want to point out that the Executive Council consists of the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, the state auditor, and the secretary of state. And that's listed within Rule 7620.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe a follow-up then. So then
is it
the governor that's responsible for calling the Executive Council to order to make such an – I mean, how does that end up happening?
Mr. Gargan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Tomasoni, I don't know the actual operational procedures, but my recollection is that the governor is the chair and does call the Executive Council to order, but I'm not – I'm just going on strictly my memory. From way back from when we sort of were asking this question ourselves back after Katrina. In this area, it has never been, we've never had an emergency called by either the Executive Council or the legislature. So this is part of the plan and how we would go about doing it. But these are good, useful questions for us to sort of have more closely at the tip of our tongues and certainly at our fingertips.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thompson.
If the governor becomes the vice president, does Senator Metzen then become part of the executive council?
I'll let you handle that, Mr.
Senator Anderson said that's scary. My dear friend, Senator Anderson said that.
I heard a gasp in the entire room. So.
Now, that's not very nice. So. My dear friend from Aiken County, wherever you're from. I was thinking it might be South Dakota the way you're talking.
We can explore every possible option of making Senator Metzen a member of the Executive Council.
Yeah.
Excuse me. As I was mentioning situation analysis and the recommendations of the least restrictive measures contained within 7620, I do want to point out that these measures include both priority uses of fuel oil and gasoline or motor fuels, which begins on page 105 of the Energy Emergency Plan. And the mandatory or the voluntary measures begin on page 108. And this relates to reducing hours of operation, having and keep in mind that there are measures in place that utilities already implement to help to alleviate tightness within their consumption or within their customers' consumption, and that would be to have those customers that are on interruptible rates you go off of their supplies and use their backup supplies if there are any, or to fire up their secondary generation sources, diesel generators and the like. In a severe situation, mandatory measures relate to the slowing down the deliveries of fuel oil or having those utilities with oil-fired generation use other sources of generation if the supply alert is, in fact, within the petroleum supply area. To give you some sense of...
Mr. Ross, I have a couple of questions. Sure. If you could back up to one of the previous slides, the question of local energy conservation boards.
The energy conservation boards?
They're established.
Mm-hmm.
Are these in existence currently, or is this something that has to be established after the declaration of an emergency? And if they are in existence currently, what is the, or in any case, what is the composition of those boards?
These would be boards that would be established after the declaration of an emergency. they're comprised of, county commissioners and other local officials. The exact composition of the Energy Conservation Board is on page 101. The chair of the County Board of Commissioners is the appointing authority to develop a five-member County Local Energy Conservation Board. This would include two elected officials from the county or municipalities within the county, a health professional, and the and the county attorney is included as an advisory board member.
And is there already some kind of a communication system in place, or would that have to be established after the fact as well?
There is a communication system in place. It would be coordinated both through our offices and through the State Emergency Operations Center.
Mr. Haas or Commissioner Garvey, what's the rationale for not having these boards in place prior to an emergency rather than scrambling to do that after the fact?
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force,
The rationale is that you want to make sure you have the set of individuals who are best capable to address the emergency on hand. A natural gas or petroleum emergency may be different than an electricity-related emergency, and therefore you would have different personnel. So the idea is to allow flexibility at the local level, but also be able to identify them.
Thank you. Mr. Haas, before we proceed, another question I had was related to the conservation measures that you were referring to. Is mm-hmm. there underlying analysis data that suggests what kinds of savings would be involved with the implementation of each of these measures?
Yes, there's some basic analysis on each of the measures as far as the magnitude of the energy savings and what it depends somewhat on the type of emergency again, but what kind of savings would be generated by each measure. And again, some of these relate to fuel emergencies and some of them relate to, you know, natural gas consumption, but the analysis for that is contained at our office. And
but the implementation would be on the basis of least obtrusive rather than most effective?
Well, the basis is based on the measures that are the least restrictive, that are still able to respond to the emergency. So that is to say, if we're in a mild shortage rather than a severe shortage, you don't necessarily have to go to the most restrictive measure within the call down list. And so, based on the analysis that our office would do in the under an energy supply emergency, we would make recommendations to the governor on which of the voluntary or mandatory measures would be necessary to address the situation.
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I think the chair's line of questioning is especially important. It's one I've been thinking about a lot. And there's a study from the International Energy Agency where they actually rank different – again, this is related to oil specifically, but I imagine you could use the methodology across the board. But they actually ranked different methods of saving energy and, how much energy would be saved, what would, the approximate cost of implementation be, et cetera. And they have kind of a whole grid around that. If you have the information in your office, I think it would be – hugely important to share that, and then we could really develop some proactive policies around that. Is that something that could be written up relatively quickly and
certainly
without a lot of expense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I think that would be a really, really helpful to us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. again, the fuel conservation measures that would be recommended are determined by the level and severity of the shortage. We kind of start with public information and voluntary measures, run through curtailment of lower priority fuel users, and then the potential is there for going all the way up to 24-hour driving bans if the situation required that. The rules are kind of outlined again in 7620 concerning how you would go about implementing that type of a measure. some of the excuse me. The Minnesota Rule 7615 relates to a petroleum set-aside program, which is which is in place to require prime suppliers of motor fuels and fuel oil to designate a certain amount of that of their supplies in a given month for allocation by the commissioner of the Department of Commerce to resolve or mitigate emergencies or hardships due to shortages of supply. This would be, for instance, this is a situation where if there were a shortage that required curtailing some of the use of fuel oil, we want to make sure that our first response vehicles have adequate fuel supplies. And this would be a situation where the commissioner could allocate a certain percentage of the monthly supply estimates for that specific purpose. 3% of the monthly supply estimate of motor gasoline is available for this purpose, and 4% of the monthly supply estimate of middle distillates, diesel fuel, and the like are available under this set-aside program.
Mr. Haas, what's the definition of prime supplier in this context?
Prime suppliers would be the bulk terminal operators, basically terminal facilities, or the refineries, which also operate their own terminal facilities as well.
And how many of those exist in Minnesota?
Throughout the state?
Roughly.
There's roughly 10, if we include some of the ones that are very close to the border. But within the state, there's probably 8.
Ones not within the state would not be subject to this.
That's correct. The third part of the Minnesota Energy Plan is the challenges or vulnerability assessment, which provides basic information on Minnesota energy consumption, and it also assesses the overall vulnerability of the three energy sectors. This vulnerability assessment begins on page 34 of the plan and provides some basic information. There is additional information on the further back, which updates the data to just bring it more up to date than what is in the initial challenges assessment on page 34. But this relates to the state's overall consumption of energy in all three sectors based on EIA data.
Mr. Haas, before we leave the set aside entirely,
mm-hmm.
That seems to be assuming that things are operating more or less normally in that sector. I mean, say we have a scenario in which one of the refineries in the state is down, and the nature of the emergency is that there's some kind of explosion or disaster that hits the other one. The set-aside specifying a particular percentage of capacity seems to me to kind of ignore a scenario in which the greatest capacity that we had would be entirely unavailable.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Garvey.
Members of the task force, what we're sort of walking through has been, I've sort of gave you a general overview of how we view emergencies generally. What Mr. Haas has been walking you through most recently in the most recent sets of slides have been sort of, we'll call it the legal framework, the statute and the rules that were applied. There'll be a couple slides, we'll actually be into the operational planning, and you'll sort of see that there are four levels that you sort of have to make that call. So it's not, so you make a call in this scenario where you came, where you just gave to, where all of a sudden we go from, it's not a short supply, it's a much more deeper, and you go deeper in. And that's, I just want to make sure we'll come back and revisit with you, because we have layers of response options depending upon how we determine the severity of the problem.
Thank you. The reason for my raising the question when I did is that it seems that the set-aside parameters that are defined in statute and rule, and I was wondering about the adequacy of those definitions as they currently exist. Mr. Ask, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the governmental response to an energy emergency is concerned, we've seen this in recent years in certain situations. And one of the primary ways that we have of dealing at least with a petroleum supply emergency is through the abatement of driver hour requirements and environmental controls, although we haven't necessarily seen environmental controls be waived in Minnesota. Other states have used that as a tool for helping to address fuel shortages. The abatement of driver hour requirements is a tool that's available to allow drivers, jobbers, if you will, to drive further distances to petroleum terminals that aren't necessarily close to their prime customers. And we've seen this in recent years in some of the more outstate terminals that are unable to get adequate supplies because of a reduction in the overall system that doesn't allow pressure to be maintained to kind of these spokes off of the primary pipeline system. In addition, there's the potential for immunity from antitrust regulations, which would allow allow petroleum companies to talk about how they might address a situation within a state. There's government assistance in providing supply to critical customers. This would be speak to the petroleum set-aside program. Public appeals and public information campaigns to reduce driving. Again, this could be related to driving petroleum energy use or electricity or natural gas energy use. And then there's the petroleum supply emergency declaration or general energy emergency supply declaration. The operational plan, again, begins on page 54, or I'm sorry, 45 of the plan. And the four levels that Deputy Commissioner Garvey mentioned of an energy shortage relate to monitor and alert and mild shortage, where tight energy supplies may have short-term impacts on energy prices, a moderate shortage in which we're experiencing 10 to 15% reduction in products for 3 weeks or more, and this would be applicable to any of the three energy systems, and then a severe shortage in which we're experiencing a 20 to 30% or greater reduction in products for an extended period.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just been operational plans and was thinking about a report I heard on NPR this morning where the folks who do these things were saying, well, they expect us to have more severe weather in the Gulf this hurricane season, and they're predicting more major hurricanes. So one comes in late fall, and I'm just checking your plan to see what happens if the natural gas supply is severely disrupted. The plan says is if the shortage is due to a pipeline, natural gas pipeline disruption, impacted customers will lose service. And then it says if it occurs during winter months, governments may need to open heated shelters and take other measures to protect public health, welfare, and safety. Have you been working with local governments to have those plans?
For the heated shelters?
Yes.
We haven't been working specifically with the local governments. I believe that There are some plans in place to, you know, communicate with those governments about when and where those shelters might be established.
But this is planning after the fact rather than planning before the fact. So I don't see a plan here. I see a descriptive sentence, but I don't see a plan. And so I'm concerned that this – think about Minnesota in November. We can have a real cold snap, and that's the end of the hurricane season. This doesn't seem to meet our needs.
Commissioner Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Representative Wagenius. The issue that that you've identified, and it's an issue that we sort of identified at the outset, is a prolonged, I mean, and it can happen in either one of two settings from our perspective. One is a scenario that you postulated is a natural disaster shutting down supplies into the upper Midwest. The other is that you have a very long cold snap that exhausts the supply in a very wide scale basis. So in either way, you have a severe shortage of natural gas, which is our primary heating, as well as other delivered fuels that are used for heating, be it propane or oil. What we have is a framework for how to address that. One of the questions and one of the reasons why Chairman Hilty wanted to have Commissioner Campion and Homeland Security Emergency Managing Director Idy here is because of that interface and just those kinds of scenarios. So the plan, we think, sort of offers that template, but it's not the beginning or it's not the end. It's in a continuum of how we deal with these things. And so this may be an opportunity for Director Idy to respond on how we would deal with that kind of question.
Director Idy, welcome to the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Idy, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And Commissioner Garvey is correct in that it's a continuum of plans. And plans really are a framework which really assigns the responsibility and gives you a framework of how locals will respond. Every local jurisdiction is required to have shelter agreements in their jurisdiction with either their local jurisdiction managing it or a non-governmental organization managing the shelter. Those shelters have requirements of space and resources, one of which is backup power. If you recall, every time that there seems to be outages or we close down the freeways in southern Minnesota in particular, we do open those types of shelters which would be available and are agreements that local governments have with places like their National Guard armory, schools, or some place that would that are able to house the people that need to be housed in those areas. If it gets to a point where this is considered a catastrophic event, then we are part of the national response framework where we go to our neighbors, which are our neighboring states. So we do plan regionally, not even just for energy emergencies, but also all hazard emergency response. We work with Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and the other states in our region. And we have identified and given the numbers of people that we, Minnesota, can accommodate, we have to take in people from other states. Other states have also identified the number of people that they can take care of for the state of Minnesota if they needed to.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, then you're assuming there's plenty of petroleum to drive people all over the Pacific here. 20%, and you say that's severe, shortage. It's coming into our winter months, it's likely that it's going to also affect Wisconsin, North Dakota.
Are you telling
me there are
plans in place to have emergency
housing for folks in the metropolitan area?
Director Ide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there are plans in place where we address sheltering. Regardless of the reason for an emergency, we use sheltering. Whether or not it's heated with petroleum or with a diesel generator, there are plans for every jurisdiction to have shelter agreements.
Representative Wagenius.
Shelter agreements that will shelter all of Edina and everybody? I mean, what's going to happen if it affects everybody? I can't imagine. Do you have a plan in place to put everybody in the metropolitan area into a shelter?
Director Ide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, even though that seems to be the worst-case scenario, we don't talk about evacuating or sheltering the entire population. So if we had to shelter our entire population and every state around us had to shelter their entire population, then we would have to turn to the federal government and look at options through the federal response plan, up to and including shipping people to Florida, California, Arizona, if we needed to, in order to save their health and their safety.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Garvey.
The other way that we look at this, and this isn't members of the task force and Representative Wagenius, and this isn't necessarily in the emergency plan context, but each of our natural gas utilities has a sort of obligation under their operational relationship with the Public Utilities Commission and the people that they serve, that they have a set of plans that they have storage in place to sort of to take care of these, to think through a series of these kinds of contingencies, and they have a series of sharing relationships, because you know, yes, you have these kinds of prices at Edina may be adversely impacted, but St. Louis Park or Minneapolis or St. Paul wouldn't be, so therefore there may be ability to kind of share. And so we have there's a sharing relationship, but also they have their own set of safety and storage mechanisms, so that if you have the natural disaster, you have a storage mechanism to take up. And then you sort of restore and refill. It gets more scary, of course, is in the hyper-long temperature outage. But, you know, we basically do 100-year kind of analysis, and we basically spread that over 10 days below, 20 below days, and what does that look? Do you have enough load? Can you shed load, large industrials, and walk down? So you're basically making sure you have hospitals, schools, nursing homes, residential, and you walk out. So you're always sort of guarding and husbanding your supplies to make sure you have those kind of capabilities, so you don't go to a massive sheltering situation. You're going to a protection mechanism.
Representative Wagenius.
We're now getting to kind of we need to understand for Minnesotans. Something happens in Edina, and it happens because there's a hurricane in Louisiana. It's going to also happen to St. Louis Park in Minneapolis. We're all going to be in the same boat. How much supply do we have in reserve, given a normal winter day? How many days of supply do we have in reserve so that people don't have to leave their homes?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Representative Wagenius. Substitute Vincent Chavez is one of my gas supply experts. And so subject to, I may need to get him up here to explain this, but the utilities as a rule, gas utilities have a rule, have roughly 30% of their load always in storage that they're continually, and it depends by, it depends on the utilities. It could go up as much as 40%. So they're always basically sort of have it in storage, then they draw it down to meet the, and then backfilling. So when you have those kinds of, we'll call it supply disruptions downstream, they are always have sets of supplies and reserves that they can draw. The question then becomes is when those reserves start drawing down and beyond that, that point. And this is where then they have a series of built-in supply contracts elsewhere to try to always do that. And, it, you know, we try to bound these with sets of rationalities, and then we sort of basically pick the next double contingency to make sure that we're dealing with these kind of things.
It just basically, how many days can Minnesotans feel comfortable that there's a gas supply in reserve?
Identify yourself.
Chairman Hilty, commissioners, my name is Vincent Chavez. I'm with the Office of Energy Security. We plan each year the utilities, the natural gas utilities that are regulated, which there are five, six of them, submit a plan to address winter heating needs. They plan for a critical day, which is a 1 in 20. So once out of every 20 years, we look at how cold it is and see what the lowest amount will be and how much you'll need for a 24-hour period below zero to meet that capacity for each day. They contract for that amount for the at least the three center winter months. That would be December, January, and February. So that's under contract for firm customers, and that's on a daily basis. They also carry a 5% reserve margin above what that one-day requirement is. So during the most extreme case, they can also pull on their LNG, liquefied natural gas, or propane facilities to inject. Those have a 10-day amount, but that is the added redundancy above their contractual levels.
It's not really the contractual levels that I'm asking the question about. What I'm asking the question about is the contractual supply has been disrupted. There's been a hurricane in Louisiana. We have, you know, what nature gave us. There's no evil person here, just a big old hurricane. We've seen them before. So there is an actual disruption. We're not getting our supply. My question is, how many days do we have in reserve for Minnesotans? How many days can they be assured that there is enough heating supply?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there was a situation during Rita and Katrina. There are supply contracts, and we in Minnesota are fortunate enough to receive gas from the north, from the Canadian supplies, via the Viking pipeline, via the Great Lakes pipeline. We also receive gas out of the mid-continent via Northern Natural Gas. In fact, our main supply comes out of mid-continent. We also get gas under new contractual arrangements out of the Rockies. So this is the diversification of portfolio from different sources that are carried on different lines. So if there is a shortage on one line, we have access to the north and to the west for additional supplies other than just from the south.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I understand we're not answering the specific types of question.
You're not. That's true.
The reason for that, is and it, what Mr. Chavez, is we don't sort of calculate it out by days because each day is different in the winter. And so there isn't a kind of that we sort of say, well, we're going to basically stock away 120 days to make sure we're covered, because that's not the way the system is designed. What we're trying to always basically make sure is that we have enough to basically get us through all these sets of contingencies. Now, but we've built in enough of those kinds of safety mechanisms that we haven't had those kinds of problems. It's important that we have this conversation. This is a useful conversation. But it's also important for the task force to understand that for natural gas supplies, we do have a diversity of supply, we do have storage, we do have contracts, and we're not sort of a unique island because we do bring it all in. And each day is different. We have made it through, I mean, and I'll just basically make a plug for our utilities. We have made it through some very tough winters over the last several decades, and we have not had a single set of problems. And over those courses, we've had there have been sets of issues that have sort of developed that you have these. But the whole point is that you have a system that has contingencies and has safeguards. What we have here is a plan that when all those contingencies at the utility level doesn't work quite right, do we have mechanisms to start dealing with them? And our answer is yes. You can always sort of stress these systems till they all break. And that's the value of these kind of conversations and these kinds of contemplations of the scenarios. But at the same time, we need to sort of understand that you are just sort of stressing them for the examination of, do you have the contingencies covered? And so we haven't been able to answer your question specifically, but I do think, I do hope that you understand that we have a very good system, it's worked very well, and we have a set of plans that will basically carry us forward. And that what your question that you're asking is one that we will take back and do more analysis and contemplation to make sure that scenario is also part of this next iteration of the plan.
Senator Rosen, thanks for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garvey, I think the discussion about shortages and not being able to actually house all of Edina is probably an important one, but I guess I'd like to direct my question towards what is the public responsibility on this, and what are you doing about public information, the campaign for their preparedness, and their responsibility? I understand that local government and what you're doing, you know, you have a whole list of number one priorities, number two priorities, but what are you doing to educate the public as far as what their responsibility is for a shortage? And I think that's a very important part. We need to ask the public, this is what you should do, this is what you should be prepared for. And perhaps you're going to get to that. I see that you've got a little bit in the mild shortage, or you were going to address a little bit, maybe even the moderate shortage. There's things that we can do. But is that part of the plan?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Rosen, the next line in the slide up sort of shows that that what we've sort of identified is a series of gradations of supply shortages. And then under each of these, and this is going to be a question mark for you, Mr. Chairman, but under each of these types of shortages, we have a set of action items that would be triggered by the assessment of the shortage. And as Mr. Haas sort of indicated, one of the first approaches is always basically making people aware that there is a shortage and that people want to pay attention to that shortage, be it a transportation fuel shortage or a natural gas shortage. We make sure that they are understanding that they have those kind of options. And so we can go through, and that was going to be my question. The next sets of slides, Mr. Chairman, are our responses underneath each of these categories. And clearly in the first and second set is public outreach and public communication and acknowledgement of a shortage and things that you can do on a consumer response basis. When you go beyond those, then government steps in and starts directing where fuels go. And beyond that, then you have the actual emergency mechanisms of relocation and sheltering and those kinds of things. So, Mr. Chairman, if you want, we can start going through that, or we can sort of...
Well, why don't you do that, Commissioner, and then we'll see if we have additional questions.
Senator Rosendale, was that responsive?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garvey, could you in the book is where is there information about the public responsibility or is there a section? Because I do think that is an area that we need to ask the public to be aware, especially with our high fuel costs now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the information, the public information piece within the plan begins on page 75. It includes examples of, you know, some topics that may be included in an educational campaign. Part of that educational campaign is going to be responsive to the specifics of a particular situation. And so it could be any number of these topics that are included in that campaign. But, we have been dealing with some of these in anticipation of higher prices, especially higher natural gas and home heating prices in the upcoming winter and in past winters where we have, you know, basically talked about the ability for the public to do low and no-cost measures to conserve heating fuel within the home, as well as trying to press through our utility conservation programs the appliance efficiency standards and the importance of choosing the most efficient appliances when you do arrive at a situation where you're looking at retrofitting your home with a new furnace, new air conditioner, what have you. And so, the specifics of a response of a public information campaign in response to an energy supply emergency will be somewhat tweaked to the specifics of the emergency. But we do have a basic level of experience in providing that public information.
Senator Rosen, I think that's a really good point, both in terms of the individual's responsibility and also of our responsibility to make sure they have the appropriate information. In that regard, for instance, if we did have an extended power outage in the severest part of the winter, say we had a 3-4-7-day massive power outage. It's not unimaginable. It's happened in other places and other times. For one thing, communication would be very difficult if no one had any electric power available to them. So it would seem that some vital information perhaps ought to be made available to people before the fact rather than trying to do it after the fact when it's enormously more difficult. For instance, if we did have the kind of power outage in January that I was referring to, one of the things that hopefully people would be aware of, but many people probably would not, is that there are procedures that you need to do to protect your residence because everything's going to freeze up if you don't. Have a very limited amount of time to deal with that before it does freeze up. How are you going to tell people that when there's no power and they're concerned about any number of other things?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Campion, you want to address that?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly will attempt to. if you bear with me for just a moment, Michael Campion is my name, the Commissioner of Public Safety. Give me 60 seconds as kind of a prelude to this. I talked with Rocco Forte and Tim Turnbull, the emergency managers and emergency directors over in Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis the night the bridge went down. Tim Turnbull looked at me and said, we've trained for 12 or 14 different types of emergencies over some period of time. We never train for this one. The purpose in the training that folks do collectively in our business is an all-hazards approach, which means that you train for any hazard that might befall a community or a state. And we do that because it's the same responders, it's the same governments, it's the same medical communities, it's the same equipment that's used. So all of these kinds of things are used for any scenario. And the reason that the 35 bridge collapse response was so good is because people have trained together for all different other kinds of scenarios, not necessarily that one. I think the closest scenario that we train for with consistency is a pandemic flu that would closely be analogous to a fuel shortage, which is the issue we're talking about today. The reason for that is it's going to last a long time. A tornado is going to last an hour or two and be done. It's going to have a wide impact regionally. It's not going to be just a city of St. Peter. It's going to be the entire probably five-state area, if not the entire nation. It's going to require all response from all different kinds of levels of government. It's not going to be just the city of Edina or the county of Hennepin. There's a lot of different features that are similar to what we do all the time with pandemic planning. I think that without question, since we've anticipated this meeting, that our people in our office have believed that we should pay more attention to a specific exercise dealing with fuel shortages. There's a lot of other things that we train for, but we could keep an eye on that and train specifically for that type of scenario. The principles are practiced and planned for and exercised with regularity in many different scenarios, and they do apply to this particular scenario or this set of circumstances that we've been talking about today. CodeReady.com is a website that we've had up for many months, I would say probably 16, 18 months. Anybody and everybody has access to it. It is a collaboration between the Department of Health, Public Safety, I think Hennepin County, and others. So it's a state, local, county collaboration that prepares individual families and families, literally, for an all-hazards approach to emergencies in the event that it should occur to them, and that what they need to do to prepare long-term, short-term, to take care of their families, their pets. You just name it, it's on that website. It's been we've had radio announcements, we've had TV announcements, we have billboards. So it's an outreach to the public to go to this website to specifically have some personal responsibility in preparing for, again, all hazards. I hope that adds just a little bit of clarity to what generally we try to do in public safety, along with all the rest of our partners, whether it's commerce or transportation or health or pollution control or agriculture, any of them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that response. Clearly in California, I don't think they were aware of with all the fires, and there was this comment that they were not prepared for the breakdown in the telecommunications area. So is that part of you've placed a lot of attention with the pandemic flu and all that, but what happens when the system does go down? What do you have in place to make sure that communications are going and we're able to take care of the needs of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, communications among the first responders, government agencies, so forth, or between?
Yes, mainly between that, because that's what California was hit broadside with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I don't know specifically about what took place in California, but I think our 35 bridge collapse is a good example of the legislature, you folks, responding to a need here a few years ago, funding a radio system that has adequate redundancy and has the interoperable communications for all responders to be able to communicate. And that's a big part of the reason that the success of the 35 bridge collapse really took place, is that all people, all responders, could communicate when everything else went down. I mean, if you were on site, there wasn't a phone system that would work, particularly a cell phone system. They were all shut down because of the overabundance of use. But that radio system that has been built out, it continues to be built out through the entire state, and again, with this support of the legislature, kept that response alive.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Didn't we put some more money into that, too, in the spawning bill? I believe, Commissioner?
Mr. Hilke, it's fully funded. It is fully funded, and whether it was from the bonding bill or maybe part, but we're on track to build the rest of that out in a very short order.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Garvey.
Members of the task force, another facet to keep in mind, I think, is that while an emergency, and I think the conversation that Senator Rosen had with Commissioner Campion is a useful one, is that an emergency in another setting, and you sort of take that and those of us at our level, and more importantly, those of the utilities that we're talking about and the energy supply folks, they do a lot of cross-pollinating and cross-communicating on how to address them. The example that I want to sort of bring to the task force is in western North Dakota and into South Dakota, there was a large ice storm that took out, you know, hundreds of miles of transmission and distribution lines that had a large swath of those states and their citizenry not having electricity. I mean, I know that while we haven't had one of those kinds of ice storms in Minnesota for a long, long time, I know that our utilities have been basically paying attention to how those happen and how to react. And that, I mean, I think it's important, as we always pay attention to that, is that what we have here is actually a set of plans and protocols that are all hazard, so that we don't know what the emergency is going to be. We don't know the scale, the scope, or the nature of it, but we have enough partners and enough sets of people and approaches that can sort of react in a way that responds, that addresses the problem. It limits the scope, corrects it, and most importantly protects the health and safety and then the economic well-being of those adversely affected. Wide scale, massive shortages. I think then we go into the pandemic kind of a scenario that Mr. Campion talked about, where we have those kinds of discussions already underway too. We don't have every base covered because we can't. But I think it's important to say that we are preparing for all those bases by identifying the biggest ones we can.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you. In response to Representative Hilty's question of how do you communicate with people and shouldn't you do it beforehand, you said that you had this web page that's available to everybody, and about it, and I just talked to my colleague here. He didn't know about it. How many Minnesotans, have you done a kind of a survey check to see how many Minnesotans know about what they should be doing and
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we can tell how many people have accessed the website. Yes, I don't have a total, but I think the response the first, I think, few months was very robust. It was an awful lot of people that did respond to it, or I did access the website. I could figure out how many people in total have responded, but I don't know it as I sit here. I didn't think to access that before we came today. You've been doing it. We did fly around the state. We do have a number of billboards. We do have a number of radio announcements. It continues to go on. I think I said television. I'm not sure television, but I know radio spots are continue to take place. In the first responder community, I think it's pretty well known. It was very well received, and I think locally, I know folks in Hennepin County, because they were partnering with us, we've really promoted it. Tim Turnbull was a big supporter, for instance, somebody in your county. But how many people access it, I couldn't tell you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I don't think you can see how many people on the site answers any question. They could have been.
Mr. Chair, I would say one other thing. Again, I said this was kind of like a pandemic, preparing for a pandemic. we are going to have some lead-up time to a pandemic outbreak. It's not going to happen, you know, within a matter of hours. We will know literally days or weeks before a pandemic reaches this country. There will be time, one would think would be some adequate time, or hopefully would be adequate time, for public service announcements as it comes. I think it would be similar to a fuel crisis. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen Wednesday morning of this week. It might happen 10 days from now, but there will be lead-up time. There'll be opportunities for local units of government, the governor, I mean, any number of different people, Department of Public Safety, officials in Le Sueur County to get on and inform their populations of what they need to do, how they can prepare, where they need to go, what they need to do. Again, it's not like a tornado where we get bad weather at noon and 6 o'clock. St. Peter, Minnesota is gone. It's not that kind of a scenario. So there will be time, not only with a website, but certainly other opportunities through the media to prepare as best we possibly can the citizenry for whatever emergency might take place.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, I would point out that if we had a major power outage, you don't have any notice about that until the lights go out generally.
Mr. Chair, point well made.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. One more question. I believe in the pandemic flu, I could be wrong on these figures, but I know we at least funded $12 million to prepare for local units of government with masks and all the appropriate non-contamination type of equipment. Is there anything with this plan that is going to need some further funding from the state to prepare? Mr. Garvey or Mr. Haas? Are we set to go?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Rosen, I've been working on this plan. Was developed about 18 months ago and as an update to our previous plan before that. I've been working on the assumption that it is the framework and the guidepost and not a funded that it sort of asks for funding. So I'm not so that I think that's my answer, but it, based upon your question, I want to think about that a little more to sort of see. But we've been working that it's not a funding. It's more like the plan for how to respond to the various types of emergencies.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garvey, don't think too hard. Don't try to come up with something.
I'm not. I mean, I want to basically make sure that I haven't answered. I haven't thought through that question. But we've been working on an assumption that it's not a fundable. It's not a funding kind of thing. It is a foreknowledge, planning, implementing, acting, correcting, improving, addressing. One other ing word, Mr. Chairman. Would you like us to go back through the remaining six slides?
Yes, why don't you do
all
that?
Right, back to you, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. I'll just step back one slide. As was mentioned, there's four levels of an energy shortage that are kind of addressed within the energy emergency plan. The first level, which isn't discussed here, is basically monitor and alert that before an energy emergency plan or energy supply emergency of any magnitude would be declared, there's this monitoring that goes on, and it would go on by our office, by the utilities, by the Midwest Independent System Operator, by petroleum suppliers, refineries, pipeline operators, etc. That if there is a situation that warrants notification to be made to the appropriate authorities, be it our office, be it HSEM, that information is based on current supply data and kind of a forecasting effort that's undertaken by our office and by the utilities. we would receive, or the appropriate authorities would receive information from the investor-owned utilities and the Midwest Independent System Operator if an electric capacity deficiency is anticipated. Normally, under even a mild shortage situation, utilities and petroleum suppliers are typically able to provide a seamless workaround. This is done by providing utilities calling on their voluntary load management customers, their interruptible customers, to either switch over to their secondary source of fuel or secondary source of supply. In the case of petroleum suppliers, if it's a particular terminal that is the source of concern, that jobbers and other people within the supply chain are able to go to alternative terminals to obtain adequate supplies for their areas. Now, this kind of has a cascading effect that, you know, over time, as that situation goes on, you put more and more strain on the larger terminals, and unless the situation is addressed through an introduction of supplies, that's where further actions such as driver's hours of service waivers might be called for to help to alleviate some of the regulations and to get additional supplies to the end-use consumers. In addition, natural gas local distribution companies may warn authorities of potential supply problems, such as the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. But again, gas providers typically are able to find alternative supplies for this type of a mild shortage response. Under this situation of a mild energy supply shortage, an energy supply alert could be declared. The Department of Commerce, through the Office of Energy Security and the Homeland Security and Emergency Management, could consider public information campaigns to inform consumers about ways to reduce demand. Those public service announcements could be issued requesting that consumers take voluntary actions. Again, this PSA could be spun as if to say that if these actions aren't taken, there may be mandatory actions that would be required. And then again, the Department of Commerce and Homeland Security Management would continue to monitor the supply and demand situation and address those as needed. Under a moderate shortage, where we're looking at between a 10 and 15% supply reduction, we're going to see a situation where utilities and petroleum suppliers are finding it increasingly difficult to provide those seamless workarounds that we usually aren't aware of. Natural gas companies may request that emergency supplies be delivered from unaffected suppliers, that there may be spot market purchases that would be made, the curtailment of interruptible customers, and the switch for those customers to go over to either propane or fuel oil to continue their operations. Would be put out as well, and in addition, the potential for adjusting gas pressures or augmenting supplies with liquefied natural gas and propane exists as well. under a moderate shortage, the response is typically, again, the energy supply alert, driver's hours of service waivers being put into place, increased efforts to provide public information, as well as continued analysis of the energy supply situation. Under a moderate shortage, we may begin implementing the voluntary and least restrictive measures that are outlined in Minnesota Rule 7620 that we've discussed. And then ultimately, if the situation warrants it, the State Emergency Operations Center may be activated and an energy supply emergency may be declared. A severe shortage in this case is classified as anything that would result in a sustained 20 to 30% supply reduction in the area. Area utilities may request government approval to implement a schedule of mandatory conservation measures and/or rolling blackouts if the situation again got to an extreme case. Commercial and industrial hours users may decide to limit their operating hours to help deal with the energy supply situation. Under severe shortage response, the energy supply emergency declaration would be in effect. The State Emergency Operations Center would be activated. There would continue to be driver's hours of service waivers if it was a petroleum situation that was the subject of the supply emergency. Our office, the Department of Commerce through the Office of Energy Security, would provide recommendations on the appropriate course of measure implementation to reduce consumption, and we'd be communicating with state set-aside needs to prime suppliers for our priority users, first responders, and the like. I'm sorry. And then the heated shelters that we've discussed may be necessary for dealing with a situation that would be severe in the magnitude of the energy shortage during a winter month. Again, these are kind of guidelines for dealing with various levels of energy supply emergencies, and certainly there hasn't been specific situations that have been outlined as far as how you would deal with a electric supply or an electric outage of a certain magnitude, but we're confident the guidelines provide a general framework that would help guide us to address these emergencies if one were to exist.
Senator Pretner-Sola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hazy, actually, I like your plan.
Thank you, Senator.
The question I have, though, is whether or not this has been articulated to the local units of government and if they have bought into this and if they will be cooperating with you. And do they know about it, basically?
Mm-hmm. We certainly have tried to make them aware of it. I don't know that everyone knows about it yet, but we can certainly try to continue those efforts through our Homeland Security and Emergency Management counterparts to try to make sure that everyone is aware of this situation. It's, you know, we've tried to make it at least available to a certain extent through our website and through individual notifications, but certainly probably not everyone is aware of the plan.
Mr. Cross and perhaps Director Ide, I think part of this question would be whose responsibility is it to make sure that the plans that local units of government are supposed to have in place are in fact in place and that the communications channels exist with all of the proper players identified and
Mr. Chair, it is the responsibility of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to ensure that our communities are prepared. So we do have requirements that that the local plans are reviewed every year by a certain body in a rotation. We also have training and we have educational opportunities, which this type of plan is presented to the emergency management community so they know what the Department of Commerce has and how it works with the state plan and then how that also works with their local plan. So we will take that responsibility to ensure that they understand this energy supply emergency, and they also work particularly with their local utilities, municipal utilities, the rural electric co-ops and such.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the plan, but I'm a little concerned about the fact that that LNG and propane are considered backup for other kinds of fuel, when in fact those the regular people who need that supply because it's their primary supply might have an interrupted source themselves at the same time that the other person needs the backup from propane or LNG. So how are we certain that we can supply all those and have enough backup for everybody to have some? I mean, you just can't take coal into, you know, or a different kind of fuel and put it in a propane burner.
Mr. House.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pariseau, it's CenterPoint Energy has a large facility that during the summer months compresses natural gas as well as propane. It's my understanding that a propane fuel can be blended to have the same burn characteristics as natural gas, and that's one of the measures. That's one of the backup abilities that the gas company has to deal with periods of both tight demand as well as the potential for a supply emergency like this. That's part of the reason why that's been included in the plan, as you've mentioned.
As a follow-up, has there been some consideration of the interruption that might cause for the people who depend on those other alternative fuels? I mean, you know, so if they were hoping to have theirs, so I was out for 24 hours in the middle of winter last year, and they couldn't send anybody out. But, you know, what if you had a week of interruption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pariseau, it's again in the particular instance that I mentioned, the supply is taken during the summer months when the demand isn't as high for those fuels, and in a situation where there were a need for propane during the winter months. That supply would certainly be available to to homeowners in the like, primarily through the bulk terminals, and so it's, I don't know that there would be a situation where propane would be necessary on a large scale during a winter heating emergency.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you know, I guess I don't have the document in front of me, but, you know, when Senator Olson did that bill last year on a study for geothermal heat pumps, was that done by your office?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Kubley, yes.
Okay, well, you know, to either of the witnesses, I guess, you know, I noticed on page 40, you know, under indigenous fuel sources, I agree that we don't have an abundance, but it does seem to me we aren't using the ones we do have either. I think the geothermal piece, you know, could certainly add to, you know, the conservation piece that is asked of utilities and could move us more in a direction of becoming at least semi-independent of other sources. But in that report, you know, some of the things, well, XL says that it costs a little less than $300 a year to maintain a geothermal system. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, the open loop systems are cheaper to install, but they're also, you know, higher priced to maintain. But there isn't any indication in that report that they're even aware of more than one kind of system. It seems to me that that's kind of a major flaw in that study, Commissioner, and I guess, you know, I would think that we'd need to take another look maybe at least at that piece of it. You know, I know Xcel says that they're controversial, but, you know, last year there were 800 and some thousand of them installed nationwide. I don't think that many people would be putting them in if they were that controversial, do you think? I mean, I don't know. I don't have the report in front of me. I wish I'd brought it along, but.
Senator Kubley will have the opportunity to get into this in some depth because Senator Prettner-Solon and I have discussed the possibility or the likelihood that will be a subject of one of our future
all right.
meetings.
Well, you know, I guess I was looking, Mr. Chair, for some mention of the geothermal option in this report, and I didn't find any. It seems like it would have fit under this indigenous resource here, and so I was just curious, you know, why that wasn't a piece of what was considered.
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Kubley, first as to the report itself, that the report is a useful piece of information as part of the dialogue on geothermal, and it's being roundly tested. The legislative hearing will give it, you know, that much more opportunity to be tested and having a discussion on that. As far as the inclusion or the lack of inclusion of geothermal and a series of other kinds of technologies, we tried to sort of just sort of keep it within specific zone. It's not that, and it wasn't that we said no, we're not going to take geothermal. It's just that we tried to sort of stay in a zone of those that were going to address emergencies.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's helpful.
I do have a question. It's sort of a scenario that has occurred to me. Suppose that there was a revolution in the Middle East, say in Saudi Arabia, in which there was virtually no warning that this was going to take place, and say also that it involved the use of a nuclear device that was employed to entirely wipe out their capacity to ship petroleum. Political considerations of a successful revolution notwithstanding, that's something that would happen just immediately. The public would be aware of that at the same time as all of the officials that are monitoring these situations are virtually so. And it seems to me that the first thing that would happen in such a scenario is that globally there would be an enormous rush to hoard petroleum, with the prospect of taking approximately 12% of the world's supply off the market instantaneously. That would almost certainly happen here as well as everywhere else, that everyone would rush to fill their gasoline tanks and their 5-gallon cans and whatever else they could put gasoline in. Have we anticipated what might happen if there were such a rush and how we might be able to deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, let me start, and then perhaps Jeff and Director Eide could sort of pop in. I think it's safe to say that if all of us went out today and topped off our gas tanks,
we'd have an energy emergency.
We'd have an energy emergency regardless of what happened in Saudi Arabia. So the transportation fuel is literally a very fluid, very quick in, quick out kind of process, and you know, rushes occur. You have sort of shortages. Clearly, if the scenario that you occurred, it would have ramifications beyond just Minnesota, but nationally and internationally. The good side is Minnesota gets most of its petroleum from Canada. While we do get, and we're interconnected with the national level, so you do have that as a safeguard, at least from the Minnesota perspective. But we would go immediately into our fourth severe shortage kind of scenario, and everyone would know about it, and we'd have to start taking severe ameliorative steps and handle the situation as best we could at the national, regional, state, and local levels. I mean, I'm not sure how else, I mean, unless Jeff and Dr. Eide have run the scenarios more specifically than that, that would be...
Director Eide, is this something you discussed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, nuclear detonation is something that that we have discussed on the national level and on the local level, and I'm not being curt, but if a nuclear detonation happened in the Middle East, fuel shortage would not be our major priority. Our major priority to look at first would be the health and safety of the people that live here, and the potential cascading effects of a vast incident of terrorism. And that would kick in a catastrophic event for the entire nation. And every intelligence agency, every emergency management agency, and every first responder would kick into gear, and we would make sure that that we recommended and ordered protective actions for our people, first from incidents of terrorism and effects of a nuclear detonation, wherever it may be, looking at all the meteorological conditions. And then the cascading event with the petroleum and the energy shortage then would be secondary. When we have a state emergency operations center, Commerce is in there, and they are the subject matter experts on energy, and so we would turn to them for their portion of that, just as we would turn to health and the Department of Energy federally on the radiological and nuclear side.
Mr. Haas?
Chair Hilty, members of the task force. absent the severity of the situation that you described, we have had situations where there have been a kind of quote-unquote run on the pumps. Quite honestly, I can tell you that it doesn't take much. If a retail outlet in Ohio accidentally puts up a 5 instead of a 2 or 3 or 4, the rumor mill can certainly run rampant, and it really doesn't take a long time for folks to start running out, getting supplies, and moving the supplies from the gas tanks and the terminals into the vehicles. I mean, it's really just a shifting of that supply, and it creates more of an artificial shortage than an actual shortage in this instance. You know, in those situations, it is important to try to, you know, get in front of the message and you know, try to influence individuals not to top off their tanks. But it can certainly be difficult. It's something that may require, you know, local law enforcement if the need is there. But that shifting hopefully would subside, you know, within a certain amount of time, and the supply system is robust enough that supply can be sent back or can be provided, you know, in a relatively short time frame.
Saudi Arabia cuts off power.
In the event that that we were cut off from the Middle East, the what we're going to be realizing is, as Deputy Commissioner Garvey mentioned, is more of an economic emergency where the prices for those fuels are going to increase dramatically, and they may increase absent, you know, a market movement in response to that type of an event where retail outlets, because they don't know if there would, because of the uncertainty surrounding the availability of supplies in those situations, would be, you know, likely to increase their prices in response to it.
In the event of a declaration of a severe energy emergency, what kind of authority actually exists? And who would exercise it? Do we have the authority to curtail retail sales or do anything about,
Mr. Chairman,
excessive pricing, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman, members of the task force, if there is a severe shortage and a declaration of emergency is called by the legislature or the executive council, there is the authority to ration and to allocate transportation fuels.
Who has that authority, Commissioner?
I believe that authority would be exercised by the governor.
Well, not directly, no doubt. So what would be the channel of command?
I believe that the way the statute is drafted is that we would advise him, the governor would execute that, and that we would be asked, working with our other agencies, implementing it.
We being the Office of Energy Security?
Of the Department of Commerce, yes, sir.
Well, we have kept everyone here for an extended period of time. Are there further questions from members before we conclude? Let me say to all of the testifiers, we appreciate your testimony and candor and efforts in this regard. I think it's something we should have some continuing conversations about. And as I had mentioned, I think to all of you earlier, I think the interest in this committee generally is not only what is the status of our preparation for this, but insofar as it could be improved, what specifically would be the role of the legislature in making any of those improvements. I think we would be very receptive from all of you to any suggestions that might involve legislative action that perhaps would be necessary from your perspective and analysis to make us as secure as possible without going to absurdities. But anyway, thanks again. And Deputy Commissioner Garvey, to you especially, thank you for your service. We will miss your face at the witness table.
Seriously.
But I'm sure we'll see you around.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the task force, this will be the last time I appear before this body as a public official. And I just want to sort of say that the last 2 hours that we had is an example of the importance of and candidly the cherished working relationship that we've had. Discussing very important issues in thoughtful and depthful ways, challenging each other. And over the course of the last 5.5 years that I've been serving this role and working with you, I believe we've accomplished extraordinary amounts that'll serve the people of Minnesota extraordinarily well. And I just want to sort of say I'm very, very proud to be able to be a Minnesotan and have worked with you to help achieve those accomplishments. And thank you very much, Chairman Hilty, Chairman Prentner-Solin, and all the rest of you for the courtesies and support and friendship you've been giving me and my department over these last 5 years. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks. Members, before we adjourn, we have tentatively scheduled a meeting for October 17th, the subject of which would be the sweet spot study. And it may be an opportunity to include other topics if people have interest and suggestions. But I think that that's a subject that of sufficient interest and complexity that it can easily occupy the entire meeting. In any case, all of this is somewhat subject to change, but tentatively we would be meeting at 1 o'clock on October 17th on that the subject of that study. There are no questions or comments at this point. And seeing none, meeting is adjourned.
Great to see you. Great to see you.